I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Climate change, putting the planet at risk, is coming. Whether or not our national government wants to face it, the weather shocks keep coming, and the dire news, like the World Wildlife Fund's finding that half the animal kingdom has disappeared since the 1970s. A little more than half, the birds, half the reptiles, half the fishes, amphibians, and mammals, all done in by human activity of one sort or another. There's more scary news out there than we can digest. Rising seas and a California mega drought. Carbon in the atmosphere well up into the danger zone. And a sort of general panic keeps rising that the climate is too big to bail, that the problem is beyond hacking. But the spirit of this hour begins with just the observation that the wind of critical, maybe creative and popular thinking is changing too. Our guests are three self-starters in a renewed battle. Jeremy Grantham is a hugely successful investor who has been putting the proceeds for years now into the race of our lives. Touch and go for the planet, he says. And the food and farming crises that could make energy issues look easy. Chloe Maxman is the point of the lance among Harvard undergraduates, telling their university to get free of its multi-billion dollar investments in fossil fuels. And David Keith is a physicist at Harvard, taking on the geoengineering riddles. Would we know, if we had to, how to fertilize the oceans and rebuild the fish population, for example? Would we take a chance someday on putting reflective aerosols in the atmosphere to dim the sun's rays and cool this planet? For starters, we asked commuters at South Station in Boston what they're ready to do differently, alone and together, in actions large and small.
I have a 5-year-old granddaughter, so I do worry about the future of the planet for her, but I think the politicians and the government are going to be more worried about the economy and terrorism. So I think it's going to be up to us as individuals.
There's lots of different legislative things that can be done, from cap and trade programs or better regulation on things that emit a lot of carbon.
I would say compressed natural gas would be much more efficient than, you know, burning regular gasoline. It burns so much cleaner and there is an abundant supply of it.
The government should do more to promote public transportation and recycling.
Well, in my home, I have all energy efficient bulbs.
Also like they do in Europe with rooftops with plants to get rid of the CO2.
My friend's dad put a small boat in front of a giant coal boat or something like that was bad for the environment, and so the boat couldn't pass and then he got arrested.
I don't know. Everybody does a little piece, so I don't eat meat or dairy, and I try to only eat local vegetables, wash my clothes in cold water. I don't know. You just do small things.
Jeremy Grantham, you're up first. Introduce this race of our lives, you call it, and handicap it. Where are we?
Well, I think you can divide most people into cornucopians or optimists and Malthusians or pessimists. And what I found is that both groups underestimate the other side of the argument. Personally, I've spent most of my last 10 years being a Malthusian, recognizing that you can't have compound growth in a finite world. But I have recently become really impressed by the incredible speed of the progress in alternative energy, particularly solar, but also wind, and the holy grail, as they say, of storage, of energy storage, where there's an absolute ferment of activity everywhere working on it. And it's hard to know for sure what will happen, but surely some of these 15 or 20 promising strains will come through. And solar is already competitive in the best places. Wind is already competitive in the ideal places for wind. And they're moving so fast that come back in 20 years, and it's pretty clear to me that we will have a situation where they are really the dominant cheap fuels.
We've been told for so long that jobs and growth are needed more urgently than environmental rescue. That seems to be crumbling. It's certainly under challenge. What do you believe?
And how do we come to believe that in the first place?
Well, I think we're facing a well-funded, brilliant obfuscation enterprise by the energy interests. And jobs appeals to everybody, so they say it's jobs. But in fact, of course, there are more jobs in solar, intelligent grid, and wind, and other energy efforts than there is in oil. Oil is actually rather low on the energy intensity. Alternative energy is very high indeed. So it will create plenty of jobs. It's a great rebuilding opportunity, like recovering from a war, to go from a whole globe run on fossil fuels to a globe run on alternatives. Will chew up our capital and our labor for decades to come.
You've put substantial amounts of your money by now not into conservation or buying up land, but into information, journalism, a kind of mind war. How's it going? What are you up against?
Well, I mentioned we're up against people who have 30, 40 years of experience, and they've done a darn good job. In fact, up until very recently, they were kicking our asses all over the place. I think now, in the last 2 or 3 years, the good guys have gotten more organized, and there are lots of little grassroots propaganda enterprises, as I like to call them. And we have tried to fund the most effective ones of these, and frankly, they're moving along quite nicely. I'm very proud to say that we invested heavily in this year's Pulitzer Prize winner and last year's Pulitzer Prize winner. If I live to be 1,200, I won't do that again.
What fascinates me about you is that you may have been a natural-born tree hugger, but you come to all of this as an investor, watching prices, watching shortages, reading the news, and connecting the dots as most news people don't. How does a man do that?
I think it's natural predisposition to look at the data and go with the data. And I don't know what I'd do if I had to rely purely on ethics. And this is an ethical issue, too. But I think the data speaks pretty clearly for itself.
Too much data out there for us to read. What leaps out at you?
Well, the progress in alternatives and the logic of going in that direction when you know that the other alternatives, how dangerous they are, you know how the costs of generating oil supplies is going through the roof. It's been compounding at 14% a year for the last 12 or 13 years, and there's no sign that it's going to stop. It's just simply getting more expensive. The oil companies spent $50 billion, the public ones, looking for oil in 2005. They spent $250 billion in 2013, and they found less oil. That's all you really need to know. We're in the end game for finding oil. So it's not just the oil is bad for your health, the oil is terrible for the planet, it's threatening our very existence, but it's also that it's running out.
But you like to say that food's running out too, and the chemicals that make it are running out. I mean, I'm fascinated how an investor notices the peculiar value of phosphate, for example, where it is, who controls it, and the shortage of it in the near term. And what it tells you?
We just got into what it takes to grow food, and there are four critical factors. You've got to have water, soil, potassium, and phosphorus. Mm-hmm. Potassium and phosphorus, without them, you can't grow any living thing. And at the moment, our agriculture depends on mining them. And obviously, by definition, they're finite. So we have a system completely dependent on two elements that will run out as a mineable product. Mm. We have simply, obviously, got to transpose our agriculture into using the very small traces of potassium and phosphorus in the bedrock, which we're blessed with, and we can do that if we change our agriculture fairly profoundly, which we're very, very slow to do. And Morocco has 75% of all the world's known phosphorus. And
really?
that is the probably one of the most dangerous factors that we face. 75% plus or minus 10% of something you absolutely have to have in modern agriculture. Mm. And if you took that out, if ISIS or some other weird group decided to take it over just to create a crisis, we would have perhaps 30 or 40 years before we hit peak phosphorus in the rest of the world.
I read you to the effect that fertilizer, food prices, agricultural production, erosion, floods are going to make the oil peak look simple. I mean, peak oil, I should say.
Yeah, I think we have wonderful alternatives to oil. We just need to get over the political problems and the vested interest problems. We don't have a good alternative to changing our agriculture, which will be very difficult. We must do that. And if perish the thought we actually hit these 12 or 14 billion people that they're talking about, then we will have a – it will be easy to have a crisis.
Can I ask, why do I suspect that the poor world, the hungry world, the world at the edge of shortages understands this problem somehow better than we richniks in the Anglo-Saxon white guy world?
Well, that's how life works. We're blessed in North America. We have five or six times the water per capita that China has and five or six times the land per capita, arable land per capita that China has. Why would we panic first? We have everything except a fairly limited amount of phosphorus. But in Africa, they're right on the cusp. And in North Africa, I would say they show every sign of beginning to disintegrate, unfortunately. And who will pay the bill to import the wheat for Egypt? Their population is growing from 84 million today to 140 million for sure, given the profile of their population. They can feed about 40 million. They're going to have 140. Who's going to pay for the 100?
Hold it there for a moment. We're talking with self-starting citizens in a changing climate conversation. Coming up, is there any fixing the atmosphere to save us? David Keith is a bioengineer who can imagine bleaching the skies a hazy white to deflect the sun, if we absolutely had to. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. On global warming and the climate crisis, we're rushing toward ruin, we all know, but along the way, movements and ingenious initiatives keep popping up too. Geoengineering is the name given to macro interventions to repair the damage to oceans and air. If we can't change ourselves, can we tweak the life support systems out there, which is to say, re-engineer the planet? These are questions that drive David Keith in the physics department at Harvard. David, give us a picture, an example of what you mean by geoengineering, a device that we might want someday.
So it's possible, it seems really clear that it's technically possible, that one could reduce some of the damage from the accumulation of carbon in the atmosphere by putting reflective aerosols, fine particles like clouds are, into the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere. So you might put sulfuric acid, a pollutant to fight pollution, if you like, into the stratosphere. And you do that in a way where you gradually increase the amount, and that would reduce or slow down the rate of climate change. And climate models, the same models that show us what the risks are from accumulating carbon dioxide, suggest that doing that would reduce the risk substantially in most places in the world, both to humans and to natural systems. But in introducing this, you said that we could do this instead of changing ourselves, and I don't think that makes any sense at all or is supportable. So in the long run, if you want a stable climate, you have to stop putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And it would be wonderful if Jeremy was right and we were going to run out soon, but I actually think that's very unlikely.
We're not going to run out of what?
Coal or gas or oil. There's immense amounts of fossil fuels underground, and humans are very ingenious about digging them up. And we have to make a social choice that we're going to stop putting carbon in the air if we want a stable climate.
You had your great awakening in Calgary, Alberta, in Canada, Canada's version of Houston, deep in the oil industry. But it was one of those occasions where the flood of the century recurred, what, twice within a few years, and you said, wait a sec. Describe your...
Yeah, I mean, I've actually worked on this topic for 25 years and actually started working on it here when I was a student at MIT, but The Calgary flood did flood my house, so I did have the experience of being on national TV as a climate scientist in front of a flooded house. And had the interesting experience of the way people pulled together after a flood that was actually positive, and saw the way the oil industry reacted in a kind of odd denial.
We've read about, and this is thanks to Naomi Klein, who has to be factored in as part of the new conversation, but an entrepreneur named Russ George, who dumped tons and tons of iron dust off a fishing boat to create an algae bloom that would sequester carbon and combat climate change, and it sort of repopulated the zone with fish. Does this qualify? Is this a fair test of these? Sounds like pretty high-risk rolling of the dice experiments.
So Russ George's idea, well, it's not his idea, but this idea of putting iron in the ocean, I think it's reasonably clear that at some basic level it doesn't work. So all the leading people who think about this geochemical cycling in the ocean as the issue pretty much agree that even if you did the entire ocean with iron, you would do essentially nothing, a few percent of current emissions. So I think there's a pretty resoundingly clear answer that that's not a useful thing to do. And Russ George's thing seemed more like a stunt than an experiment. It wasn't controlled. There wasn't a real science done in a serious way.
How many people get to vote on these experiments when somebody, you know, pulls the trigger?
Well, there aren't any experiments that are serious yet for the things that I'm talking about, which is the question of whether or not we would put reflective particles in the upper atmosphere. I and Professor Jim Anderson at Harvard are working on the development of an experiment, and we would only do it if it was publicly funded and publicly approved through the sort of normal channels that we do that.
But would the Secretary General of the United Nations sort of bless it in the end?
No.
Would China get to vote on it?
The experiment that we're talking about would be putting less sulfur in the stratosphere than 1 minute of flight of a conventional aircraft that people fly in all the time. So the actual risk of doing that experiment would be tiny. We're talking about putting 100 grams of sulfur in the stratosphere, which is sort of the equivalent of a minute's flight of a plane you might take from here to London. So the actual direct risk of these early experiments would be essentially zero. But the issue that concerns most people about this is a concern about something that's often called moral hazard, the idea that the possibility that we could reduce the risks and not eliminate them but reduce the risks of the accumulation of carbon dioxide will somehow cause people to lose their commitment to cut emissions. And I think that's a valid concern, but it's actually hard to ethically support the idea that one should not take seriously something that appears to be one of the few things we could do over the next half century to really help prevent risks, especially to the most vulnerable.
David Keith, I take it from conversations with you that in the end, in your mind, it's not about changing minds or even changing politics, but about changing the technology in place, replacing fossil-fueled industry and transportation and home heating with renewables. Is that a fair summary?
Well, no. I think ultimately these things are fundamentally political choices, and the way that we get technological change like this to happen is through making it illegal to use the atmosphere as a waste dump for carbon and then to let people innovate about how they're going to figure out how to do that. But I think the idea that technology kind of magically solves problem without human decisions, without ethical decisions, without fighting is absurd. Mm-hmm. If you think back to the big environmental problems we have solved, and it's important to say we have, they've been done with immense fights.
Remind us.
Well, we made enormous progress with air pollutants in this country, huge progress. The Clean Air Act, a product of government action driven by individuals and who fought against industry in some cases, in many cases, is going to add almost a year of life to an average American. It's one of the biggest single wins of public policy of all time and at comparatively low cost. So we can do that. We've also made enormous progress in blocking the chemicals that cause the ozone hole through an international binding treaty that's eliminated those chemicals. We also made huge progress in reducing organochlorine pesticides, DDT. So there's lots of things we've done, and all of those have been ultimately through laws passed because people fought like hell against opposition to get those laws passed. And the first thing you need to do that is to mobilize enough of the population to really want those laws passed.
Speaking of mobilizing the population, I want to introduce Chloe Maxmin. She was way ahead of the curve at Harvard, at the head of a student campaign to get oil and coal stocks out of the Harvard endowment. Welcome, Chloe Maxmin. Let me ask, do you have to turn around the president of Harvard before you can turn the culture or the politics around? Or maybe it works just the opposite. Maybe the president of Harvard will be the last person to on the boat. What do you think?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure.
I would like to take a step back and frame the divestment.
Introduce yourself.
Quickly.
Young lady from Maine.
Yes, my name is Chloe Maxmin. I'm 22 years old. I grew up in rural Maine, and I co-founded Divest Harvard, and I'm currently a senior at Harvard College.
Good for you.
At the beginning of this segment, we heard Bostonians calling on the government for climate action, and I couldn't agree more. But the problem is that the fossil fuel industry has captured our political system, so we can't actually achieve the political will that we need for climate legislation. This is where the divestment movement comes in. Our goal is to stigmatize the fossil fuel industry and highlight their antisocial behavior, from climate denial to political capture. And as we weaken corporate influence, we're building people's influence. We're building a powerful climate movement. And there are now over 400 student campaigns for divestment across campuses in the United States, hundreds of campaigns off campus, and hundreds around the world. And all of these campaigns, most of them, have arisen in the past 2 years. So why? I think this frames your question about Harvard as well. So the first is about agency. Divestment gives so many people the agency to take their futures into their own hands. It's about youth and my generation being able to stand up and say that we need our institutions to stand with us as we fight for a better planet. It's about agency for voters to say that we want our politicians to listen to us rather than to corporations. And it's also agency for institutions like Harvard to align their investments with their values. The second thing is that divestment allows the choice point that every story needs, because we have now created a situation where we need to make a choice if we're going to continue using fossil fuels or if we're going to create a better world. And divestment forces that choice. The last thing is that divestment is about love. Divestment is about our future. It's about everything that we care about. And I really think that that's the core of why it spread so quickly. So at Harvard, we have over 70,000 people that are calling on Harvard to divest. Our campaign is entering its third year. We've met with our administration multiple times, and multiple times we've been met with rejection. So
let me be the first to say I'm not quite clear on why the Harvard as a corporation is so resistant. Hmm. Although Drew Faust, the president, says, among other things, that Harvard is doing the vital research to replace oil with people like David Keith, among others. What do you make of the response? And is it even plausible to suppose that giant corporations and industrial interests capture universities as they capture senators and congressmen?
Oh, I absolutely think it's plausible, and that could very well be one of the reasons why Harvard has not divested yet. Other reasons that our president, Drew Faust, has explicated are that our endowment is not a political tool, that it's apolitical somehow. This makes no sense to me because we have divested from social injustices in the past. We divested from apartheid in South Africa. We divested from genocide in Darfur, from big tobacco. And the climate crisis is, in my opinion, greater than anything that's come before. And we're currently sponsoring it by investing in fossil fuel companies. And our investments are just as political as divestment.
Jeremy, can you explain this? I mean, some of us have come to think of these great universities as hedge funds that run a campus on the side. How do these things get captured? Is that the way to think of it?
I don't know. I tend to agree with Chloe on almost every point.
But let's talk about capture. Let's talk about this conversation. Let's talk about, as I was saying, how we feel maybe the last dupes in a global gamble.
I think divestment is a real threat to the ease of which you manage your pool of money like an endowment. And in general, it's a very bad principle if you allow every group of trustees to come in with their particular bee that they have in their bonnet. And my experience over 40 years is don't do it. But now suddenly we have come across the exception of all exceptions. This is an existential threat to our planet, to our own species. And not to recognize this as enormously significant, completely different, non-precedent setting, is to be narrow-minded and unethical. I think we just have to rise to the occasion as best we can.
David Keith, speak for either side of Harvard as you will.
I've been in a university that was truly captured. The University of Calgary was captured by the fossil industry, as you'd expect, and that's largely why I'm back here at Harvard, is because I was run out of Calgary for its capture. So I don't think Harvard is captured in that sense at all. I think the reason Harvard's resisting divestment is simply a kind of deep conservatism against change. And I think the reason the divestment movement is so important is that it helps to force the conversation among the elites who run, say, the Harvard's endowment. And I think in that way, I am entirely supportive of the divestment movement, because I think, step back for a second, I guess I'd say over the last decade, the environmental movement, and it's big. Think of environmental defense, for example, is $150 million a year, NRDC over 100, has chosen to play a mostly inside the beltway strategy, thinking that what they could focus on was cutting a deal in D.C. And the bottom line is, to cut a deal, you need enough people who really care at the ballot box. And they didn't have that. So while there were lots of clever people in the environment movement in D.C., they didn't pull anything useful off. And I think the really exciting thing about divestment and 350.org is it's building the political capital that we'll need. Once we have that capital, we'll need people like environmental defense or what have you to cut a deal. But right now, the cutting edge of action on climate is things like the divestment movement that's forcing people to see it as a simple moral picture and forcing people to talk about it.
I wonder, Jeremy, did you have a role in the snafu around the climate bill? What was it, 2 years ago in the Senate? 2-3 years ago? I mean, again, I have to say that sort of went past my radar at the time. But it looked like a game of capture in the Senate.
I'm ashamed to say I don't have a long background in politics. I'm not sophisticated about it. I'm happy to say that we put quite a bit of money into trying to get a climate bill. You can't win every time. We helped get it through the House, and we didn't get the support I expected from President Obama and his administration, or we didn't get the competence in the support, and we had to move more quickly. We could have had a bill. We could have gotten it through the Senate, is my guess, had we moved with more dedication on the part of the president and moved more quickly, and had the priorities with the health bill not been so obviously in favor of health and at the cost of climate.
All sorts of sensible people say the only way to get the carbon down is to tax it, to penalize the industry for the damage it does. I mean, how many votes could we get even today for a tax on carbon?
I don't know, but in the end, you need a carbon tax, and there are many other countries on the planet that will do that. For sure, before this is finished.
Let's not forget that one reason people hold on to oil stocks is that they're profitable, and also that the size and the profitability of things like ExxonMobil, which has had the best 5 years in corporate history of the planet, are simply huge. I don't want to even ask, but can we beat that game, Chloe? Just the power of the oil companies. The sheer money that they make every single year and the billions and billions of dollars.
Well, the honest answer is that I don't know. And I don't think anyone knows.
That's
no
what makes it exciting,
no
the race
ever
of our
really
lives.
Faced a crisis like this, I think a lot of people would compare the transition beyond fossil fuels to the abolition of slavery and the reformation of the slave economy. There are obvious differences, and it's a different era. But, you know, we're in uncharted territory, and divestment as a tactic is something of a last resort because other tactics haven't worked. Going through our political system hasn't worked. Creating individual change on a mass scale hasn't worked. We need fundamental system change, and it's going to take a long time to get there, but I think we will.
David Keith.
It's not just a question of the fossil fuel industry having a lot of money. They do have, and their lobbying power is very ugly. But it's a question of it's actually hard to change the energy economy of the planet to get the stuff we need, illumination, transportation, all the energy services like we have in this room, without emitting carbon. And so the challenge is actually turning over that energy economy, the entire planet, all that capital stock.
We're talking with David Keith, Jeremy Grantham, and Chloe Maxman about what feels like a turn, a change in the weather around climate. Coming up, the birth of a social movement that could be as big as civil rights or women's liberation or peace, with dimensions all its own. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Sampling the passion in the global climate fight that President Obama and the U.S. Congress seem to have abandoned in some combination of acrimony and now despair. The social historian Todd Gitlin writes that even in 2 weeks since that multitudinous march in New York, something has changed. The climate cause has become a mass movement, a mentality, he writes, an intertwined set of cultures, a burgeoning social fact. Jeremy Grantham and David Keith and Chloe Maxman, start with you, David. What is the real role overall of academic science here?
Well, the most fundamental role has been actually understanding the climate challenge. So understanding what the consequences are of using the atmosphere as a waste dump for fossil fuels and understanding what the consequences are for both humans and the natural world. So I think the single most important thing is actually understanding the risks.
Jeremy Grantham, what's your take on the role of science here and who's leading it in the right direction or the wrong?
I think we're struggling with the fact that scientists feel they're protecting the dignity of science. They don't like to be seen as being political. They don't like controversy. And in general, they keep their heads down. And when they don't, they have been attacked often with considerable effect by the bad guys. So I'm somewhat sympathetic, but this is an emergency. They need to dig deep, to be brave. I think it's fair to say there are very, very few scientists, climate scientists, who have actually said what they honestly believe in the most effective way that they could.
Explain. What do you mean? And how do you know that they're not coming clean?
Because you talk to them and you find that they're much more concerned with the speed with which the situation is deteriorating than they have actually written up and defended in public.
What's the inhibition? What's the penalty they would pay for the whole truth?
Heavy science is a very conservative industry. The last thing you want to do is to be seen to exaggerate. And that's a pretty good working rule. But as I keep teasing them, in general, exaggeration is dangerous in climate change. Underestimating is dangerous. I think the game is quite different. And I don't think they've acted as if that were the case. They have been happy to have the science underestimated by the general public, as it is and always has been. The dangers are much more real than the public are aware. And the scientists know that.
Where are the eager whistleblowers? You know,
Jim Hansen, of course, is in a league of his own. He's been out there for, 35 years, blowing the whistle as hard as he can. Where are the next two dozen Jim Hansens?
Yeah. I know him through Bill McKibben's constant praise of his example and his inspiration. Can I ask you, Chloe, you're deeply committed now to a long social struggle. Take the Keystone Pipeline as sort of the next giant event or pseudo-event or public controversy that's going to get decided significantly one way or the other. What's at risk here? And how's it going to come out? Bill McKibben thinks it can be stalled forever.
I agree with Bill. I think that the Keystone XL pipeline has become a symbol of the power that the climate movement can wield. It was a foregone conclusion that the Keystone pipeline would be approved. And because of mass mobilization, because of arrests, because of protests, it's been postponed. But it's not just about Keystone. There's a massive network of tar sands pipelines throughout the United States and throughout Canada. And it's not just about Keystone XL. It's about building resistance on every front line to ensure that the tar sands do not continue to be developed to an extent that is uncontrollable. So Keystone has just been one pinpoint in a very large network that the climate movement is mobilizing around.
Where is it going, do you think?
Well, I think that as the People's Climate March has shown, that the climate movement has so much power, and we're all around the world. We have hundreds of thousands of people who are fighting in their communities to mitigate climate change. So whenever there's a proposal for a tar sands pipeline or a natural gas well or any kind of fossil fuel extraction, there are going to be people there to stop it. And that's the kind of grassroots movement that we're trying to build.
David Keith.
I mean, it's absolutely the grassroots movement, roots movement that we need to build. But let's be cautious about overstating how much power we have now. Every year, we're building more fossil fuel infrastructure. We as a species emitted 2.some percent more this year than last year. It's an immense infrastructure. And so things like Keystone are very useful symbols that can help build political capital. But to actually get the job done, you can't just oppose individual things. You need binding laws that will drive emissions towards zero, because if you want a stable climate, you must go there. And to do that, you need to replace all this infrastructure that allows us to fly around the world, to be in rooms full of light and broadcast our voices across the planet. You must replace that infrastructure with something else, be it wind power or nuclear power, solar power, some combination. And that is not something that can be done easily, and the costs are substantial. They're percents of GDP. We can afford it. We should afford it. But we shouldn't fool ourselves. This is just sort of easy like tobacco.
We should all bring China into the conversation. China, I mean, the United States is still the world's great polluter per capita, but there's more per capita in China. And they, till recently, seem to be coming on strong with coal. How does China work in your schemes, starting with you, Jeremy?
Well, China is capable of moving at multiples of the speed that we can move because of their system of government. They also have the great advantage of a tradition of looking far further into the future than we do, of being less dominated by short-term returns. And they have moved very quickly on most of these issues. They installed more solar last year than the U.S. has in the history. And we get similar numbers in wind. They have more nuclear under development than the rest of the world added together. They are attacking pollution. They recognize how dangerous coal is. On the other hand, they have to drive forward to keep their population happy. They have enormous creative tension.
But do they still buy into the idea that to keep the country employed, you've got to accept a huge pollution penalty? In other words,
they haven't
made the turn that you have on jobs.
I think they recognize it very well indeed. I think they recognize they've got to keep driving growth, but they also recognize that in order to stay alive, they already lose 5 years of the expected life north of the river through coal subsidies. They recognize they've got to reduce the pollution and they've got to reduce the carbon intensity, and they're working very hard to do that. But they're not willing to give up growth to get there. So they're trying to do two very difficult things simultaneously.
David Keith, you work with the Chinese?
Air pollution has got to be so serious, as Jeremy said, I mean, so that people are living years less than they otherwise would because of air pollution, that it's become a threat to the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party's rule, that they have to be able to manage that if they're going to maintain that legitimacy. So I think it's gone from something that was an issue to being at the top burner. And the question is,
what they do, how fast they move, and whether they couple that with moves on climate. So I think at this point, it's certain they are and will make major moves on air pollution. And the really exciting question is, will they kind of keep the momentum doing the stuff they're committed to on air pollution and roll that on to pushing carbon emissions down? Because they're quite different problems. And I'm cautiously optimistic that they will go on to begin to really deal with CO2 emissions, and that's by pushing coal down.
When I hear his talk, I realize that however hard we try, there is no question that things will get a lot worse before they get better. And we will come very close to points of no return where self-sustaining bad things happen, where permafrost melts and methane rises and so on in self-sustaining ways. We will get desperately close to some of these dangerous points of no return. And the thing, if you can spare the time,
please,
that you, the biggest single risk from climate change that people are not aware of, in my opinion, is that a warmer air sustains more water vapor. We will have more rain. But because it's also destabilized by climate change with fatter tails, it means we get more droughts and we get very many more floods. And Lord knows, you can look around and see in the paper how enormously prevalent these great downpours are. And the downpours are incredibly dangerous because it turns out that erosion, we lose 1% of our soil every year already, which means we've got to change in 100 years. But heavy downpours do all the damage. In a power law, you get 360 days a year where really nothing much happens, and then 6 days that absolutely ruins erosion, and a couple of days that do half of that, and a couple of days every 3 or 4 years of ultimate downpours that do half of that. And what the Brits said in a peer-reviewed article a couple of months ago was that they have calculated that is precisely what is going to happen. There's going to be a fourfold increase, in their opinion, in very heavy downpours that are absolutely lethal for erosion. They will produce kind of 14-foot wide, 10-foot deep erosion right in the middle of the greatest fields of the Midwest. And we must improve at a very great rate just to offset that.
I wanted to—we didn't finish with China, and we won't, David Keith, but are you in touch with them? Do they speak your language? How's their science compared to yours?
Well, one thing is important to say is that politicians who run China are more more likely to be engineers and technocrats than
that's
ours.
True.
And I think that's really an important thing, so that most of the people who run our country are lawyers by training. And I think that part of the reason that Chinese elite seem to take climate change seriously, you don't hear the climate denial there, is that they are engineers and related professions who fundamentally buy the idea that we have some understanding of the consequences of putting carbon in the air.
Do a quick survey, if you can, of other techno fixes out there. Paul Krugman writes in the New York Times that we will be shocked to find how fast and how cheaply we can capture carbon emissions when we put our minds to it. Is that true?
I think there's really two very different kinds of techno fixes. They're all the techno fixes that reduce, that make it easier to stop putting carbon in the air. And that's everything from wind power and solar power to carbon capture on natural gas plants that puts that CO2 underground. There's a big range of things that we can do there, but none of them are magic bullets. All these things are expensive because they mean replacing the infrastructure. There's the stuff that I mostly work on as an academic, which is the idea that you could put reflective particles in the atmosphere to reduce the risk. That appears to work, but it doesn't. It only reduces the risk. It masks the problem. I think there's good evidence that we might want to do it, but it doesn't get you out of the necessity to cut emissions.
I'm thinking, looking at you three, you may be the future of this movement in various ways, or represent it. And Chloe Maxman, you may have the longest career in it. I start with you, but I wonder how you keep from being occupied. How you sustain this kind of movement against monstrous pressure?
Well, I think that for the climate movement and climate activists, our lives are defined by climate change, whether we're devoting time to the movement or not. So it's something that's omnipresent, and for youth, it's something that we think about every day as we think about our futures, as we think about what jobs we're going to have after college. So it's hard to imagine not sustaining it because our lives depend upon it. And I think that a major problem for activists is what we call burnout, which is when you're just working so hard, when you're organizing so much that you just lose all of your energy and all of your passion. So the way that I approach it is that I think it's really important to connect with the core reason why you're doing this work. And for me, that's a love for my home. It's a love for Maine. And for other people, they do it for other reasons. But I think that by really understanding what's at stake, we just have to keep going.
Jeremy Grantham, you're a long-term sort of guy. How do we all sustain this?
Well, I take a lot of comfort from Pascal's paradox, which is, you may remember, was what is the cost of not believing? What is the reward? And so on. What is the cost of behaving as if this will be very serious and is on the cusp, a matter of life and death? You end up with a cleaner planet, with more efficient technology, with less health problem. And what is the cost of acting as if we'll muddle through just fine anyway? Why waste the dough? Potentially fatal and certainly hugely risky and destructive. So is there any alternative but to assume we can make this and put into the effort everything we have?
Sounds like a version of Pascal's wager. For believing that there's a God out there who's going to reckon with your life someday. If you're wrong, you're wrong, but you lived a better life. David Keith.
I'm 50 now, and I've been working on climate as a scientist and sometime activist for half my life, 25 years. And this movement, the movement of young people like Chloe, is the most important, sort of most exciting single thing I've seen.
Really?
Yeah, I think that the science hasn't changed very much, actually. And the core kind of understanding of the problem in the minds of elites who spend their time with it hasn't changed very much. But I think that there was a time where I think, and others really believe we could just kind of talk to the other elites and politicians and they would do the thing we hope they would do. And I think maybe a decade or so, I began to realize that that really wasn't going to happen. And I think that we need some new movement with energy. And I think the honest truth is people have no idea how divestment or the People's March or 350.org exactly will turn out. And some of them will take blind alleys and fail. But we need a new movement in a new way to get people to take this problem seriously.
Let me just argue
Jeremy.
With David. The science has not made any great leaps forward, but the engineering has. In 3.5 years, the cost of a solar panel has dropped to 25 cents on the dollar. This is dramatic. This has changed the game.
Stick with it. We've all needed a big movement for a long time, and maybe this is it. Let's hope. Thank you, Jeremy Grantham. Thank you, Chloe Maxman. Thank you, David Keith. We've got an extended conversation with Jeremy Grantham on our website, radioopensource.org. The conversation includes a lot of good investment advice. I hope it's good. Here's a hint. Jeremy Grantham has predicted the last three big bubbles. You can also read an illustrated report on our site from the Climate March in New York City. Our man, Max Larkin, was there carrying the open source flag. We're proud of him. We're going out on the music of John Luther Adams, the Alaskan composer, who's also an environmental activist. This is his piece called Become Ocean. It won this year's Pulitzer Prize for music. You can read all about this work. You can hear an interview with John Luther Adams on our website. Again, radioopensource.org. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin and Connor Gillies, with help from Maria Jose Fabre. George Hicks engineered the program. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.